Welcome to The Point. I'm Elsa Partan, in for Mindy Todd. The writer Paul Theroux is known for his travel books and novels that take readers to foreign lands. Think Great Railway Bazaar, The Mosquito Coast, Dark Star Safari. He's written more than 50 books and written about unknown corners of nearly every continent. With his latest book, he comes back home to Cape Cod. And he explores one of the darker societies he's ever known, a large, unhappy American family. It's one he knows well. Paul Theroux, welcome to The Point.
It's nice to be here, Elsa.
The novel is called Motherland, and it brings us into the sphere of an elderly matriarch and her seven adult children. What is the world of Motherland like?
The world of Motherland is like a nation, like a country, like a tribe, like a corporate entity. It's dominated by the mother, and all of them have this special language that they use, their expressions. There are certain rivalries, there are certain ceremonies, like all big families. But all big families have certain similarities, and this is not an unhappy family, but it's a very talkative, very active, very rivalrous family, actually.
That's interesting. I use the word unhappy, but you wouldn't use that word.
No, it's not unhappy. Unhappy doesn't do it justice. It's beyond unhappy. It's like saying Albania is unhappy, but Albania isn't unhappy. Albania is a crazed nation of people. I've been there to Albania. It's a very odd place. And it was dominated by Mehmet Hoxha, who drove everyone mad with his paranoia. So, and rivalries and so forth. And so it's more like Albania. No, unhappy doesn't actually do it justice.
Why don't you read early on in the book to give us a sense?
Sure. Very early on in the book, I have a paragraph that begins, actually, "We're family," people say with a confident smile. And I think, "We're family. God help you." The phrase "big happy family" does not invoke a congenial crowd to me. It suggests weird corporate disorder, treachery, greed, and cruelty. The nearest thing in civilization to a cluster of cannibals. I'm generalizing here, using the word savage tribes and cannibals for emphasis and melodrama. And I know unfairly. Reading those words, you're immediately put in mind of comic, half-naked, bone-in-the-nose jungle dwellers, bone arrow people beating drums and dangerous only to themselves in their recreational violence. And of course, hollering and jumping on big feet and showing their teeth. Such people don't exist in the real world. I once lived in the equatorial regions where these belittled stereotypes are said to live, and I found the folk there to be anything but savage. They were subtle, chivalrous, open-hearted, dignified, and generous. It was in suburban America where I encountered savagery in its nakedest form and discovered all the mythical characteristics associated with cannibals to be the simple, observable facts of my own big flesh-and-blood family.
Do you think this will sound familiar to some people? Will this book ring true for some people?
I think anyone who comes from a very big family, I mean 6+ people, but there are people, I mean, I've met people in my last book, Deep South. I was traveling in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina. And I often met people who had who were one of 12, one of 15, same mother, same father. They're just children all over the place, black and white, in the Delta, in Arkansas. Very big families, farming families. Will it ring true? Yeah, I asked them. I mean, I loved meeting the people who came from big families. And I'd say, you know, who was the black sheep? What were the issues? What were the celebrations? What was your father like? Was anyone gay in the family? Usually in a big family, in a very big family, someone is gay. So it's there's a problem. and the eldest in a very big family is either a very serious, severe, and, you know, takes charge, or completely dysfunctional. Because the eldest was at one time the only child. And so the eldest is different from all the rest of them and very responsive usually, or sometimes just disappears. So it could be one thing or the other. you wonder whether does it resonate. Certainly, the people from big families who've read this book and spoken to me agree that there are certain that it resonates with them.
This family has the basic facts of your own family. There's a French-Canadian father, the Italian-American mother from Medford, who lives past 100 on Cape Cod. She has 8 children. 7 of them survive to adulthood. One of these children is your protagonist, called Jay. He's a travel writer with the rough biography of your life. You've written both fiction and nonfiction over your career. Why is this one fiction?
It's fiction because of so many liberties. I mean, one of the problems with a memoir or an autobiography is you really have to stick to the facts, and you've got to stick to the truth of your life, and that's really pretty tedious. I mean, first, having to be so scrupulous and, you know, dot every I and examine everything under the lens of did it happen or am I exaggerating? It's a trial to do that. To use your life in your work, as I have done, not only in this book, Motherland, but also in My Secret History. I wrote a book called My Other Life. Even something like The Mosquito Coast, which is a story of a family, the only other family I've written about. The father in the family somewhat resembles my father. My father wasn't a crazed, paranoid inventor, but my father had certain characteristics. He was funny like Ali Fox in The Mosquito Coast, and he tested us like Ali Fox. My father would say, you know, stand on that rock, see how long you can stand on that rock while the tide is coming in. Or we'd play games. One of the games was called Duck on a Rock. We used to play them on the Cape and when we were growing up. And Ali Fox does that to his children. So this is fiction, but it's based on my life. There are lots of correspondences in the book, but one of the, I mean, my mother wasn't as evil my mother wasn't evil at all, actually. She's very nice. And the main character, the Jay character, the narrator of the book, who may or may not be an accurate narrator, a reliable narrator of his work, he's notably unsuccessful. I don't think of myself as unsuccessful. I think of myself as very well rewarded. Jay's suffering bad reviews and bad sales, and he's living in a rented house in Centerville. People on the Cape can recognize, you know, the house with the scrubby trees, the pitch pines, the sand blowing, the rental with the Reader's Digest condensed book on the shelf you kind of inherit. That's where he lives. I do not live. I live in a much more and a happier place.
Right, right. And noticeably, Jay's personal life and relationships don't mirror yours either. In the early years, I mean, you did live in England. You do have 2 sons, like Jay does, from a previous marriage. But obviously, this doesn't follow you exactly.
No, but I did want to write a book. No, it doesn't. But with certain important differences. For one thing, my mother was not an encourager of my work, and the woman in this book, the mother in this book, is not a great encourager. And I was trying to think, as every writer, every reader probably thinks, how did that writer become a writer? How do you become a writer? Did you get a MacArthur Genius Grant? Well, I didn't. Did you get a Guggenheim? No, I didn't. Do you go to the Iowa Writers Workshop? I didn't, and lots of writers didn't. How did it happen? Often it happens as an act of rebellion. And I see that, to a large extent, that's how I became a writer. A novel about a writer is not necessarily that fascinating a book. But I hope this one is, because it's not about being a writer. It's about a family, and it's about a dysfunctional family, and the rebellion of each person in the family, the sons and daughters of the mother, who behave like children. And I realized that my resistance, my rebellion against the family, against my mother, my desire to go away and make my own life, were factors in my becoming a writer that made me a traveler. Coming from a big family, I really wanted to get away. I wanted to have my own space. I think this book sort of answers that question too. So it's not it's not about a dismal family. It's really about rebelliousness. And I suppose all the factors that make a writer. And one of them is that the mother in the book is uninterested. And the other thing is that she, because of all the peculiar factors, she's the muse of the, I mean, the main character says, she was my muse. She was my muse. Didn't read the books. Said, how are you going to make a living? What are you going to do? All of that. All of those were ways in which the main character became a writer. So she didn't drive him to the library or, you know, read to him and so forth. It's not that. It's not like the Olympic champion who thanks his mother and says, you know, this medal should go to my mother because she drove me to practice, soccer practice, whatever, every afternoon. The mother in this book didn't do that, and my mother didn't do it.
You're right. Don't fight meant fight. Help each other meant hurt each other. Harmony and peace meant their opposites. So here, none of the seven children come off as heroes in the book, and they're sort of encouraged by the mother to fight amongst themselves and have loyalty only to her. It's a dark family.
Well, yeah, I suppose it may seem dark, but that's also a technique used by every dictator, every tyrant, from, you know, I don't know, Chairman Mao to Pol Pot to Mehmed Hoxha of Albania. The technique is kind of divide and rule, and there's always in this family the father dies, the mother has issues about loyalty, so. It's very important that the children, very important to the mother's domination that the children quarrel, that she pits one against the other. She may not realize that's what she's doing, but in a way, she's sort of devising her own Machiavelli, prince. You know, she's creating her own technique for domination, much as, you know, Chairman Mao did. Or even Jesus said, you know, leave your father, leave your mother, leave your family, come follow me. And Jesus kind of rejected the family. And Mao rejected the family. He's saying, you know, you have to follow my way. I need to be in charge. And then it's kind of important that the loyalty go upwards to the person in charge, the mother in this case. So the mother works that out. Is it dark? I suppose it's dark in the way that power, the whole exercise of power, has an element of darkness in it. But to me, it explains a lot about people's lives and the way we live. And I suppose that's what a novel does. I mean, a novel has to tell you, it has to relate something that's true about the world and about yourself.
I'm talking with author Paul Theroux about his new book, Motherland. And it's about a manipulative mother and her adult children and their struggles. Our protagonist, Jay, has two grown sons who are well-adjusted and happy and successful, and they're bewildered and even ashamed that their father is taking part in all kinds of bad behavior, including breaking into his elderly mother's house. Is this how you imagine some readers and outsiders will view this family, sort of like, what is going on here? Is this how outsiders see this family? Even,
well,
readers?
If outsiders saw the truth of any family, of any person, they would be deeply disturbed and bewildered. We don't, our best selves are shown sort of outwardly. Our inner lives are disturbed and disturbing and complex and very hard to figure out. I mean, one of the beauties of the novel, of any novel, I hope this one, but you could say Madame Bovary or Huckleberry Finn or many others, is that we know the characters in the book better than we know many of our friends and many of the members of our family. You tend to know, take Madame Bovary. You know Madame Bovary very well. You know what her inner life is like. You know that she's a shopaholic. You know that she's She's very desirous. I mean, she wants to have an affair. She has two in the book, and they're failures, but and she's used by the men. But you know what she wants, and you also suffer the pains of her deception. You don't feel that about other people. You might know have a friend, but you don't know what's going on in that friend's mind. So we know the lives of fictional characters very well. This is why people are readers. It's why you rush back to your house after a dinner party, and you know, mildly interesting dinner party, but you get to reacquaint yourself with the characters in the novel that you're reading. Say, I want to go back to my novel. I want to go home and finish my novel or read another 20 or 30 pages of my book. So would an outsider be disturbed by this family? Probably. But an outsider would be disturbed by any family. By any family, and often by the inner life of any person, which is, you know, you take Ulysses by James Joyce, the inner life of Leopold Bloom or Stephen Dedalus, everything about their life. Leopold Bloom sneaking around, sending letters, his passion, his weird sexual tastes, or his wife Molly Bloom. The business with her. We know Joyce was very scrupulous in telling us everything about these people, every secret, every sin, and so we know them. I mean, you know Leopold Bloom or Molly Bloom, you know, much better than you know your high school French teacher or whatever it is.
I'm talking with author Paul Theroux about his new book, Motherland, which is about a large family. It's set on Cape Cod. I'm Elsa Partan, in for Mindy Todd. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Elsa Partan, in for Mindy Todd. I'm talking with author Paul Theroux. His new book is Motherland, and it's about a manipulative mother and her adult children. Our protagonist, Jay, doesn't tell his siblings that he has a serious girlfriend because he's afraid they'll hurt him with that knowledge. But Mother tells everyone, even though she was told not to. And one brother, called Floyd, takes deep offense about the secret, and he refuses to speak to Jay for several years. And in retribution, he's a professor and he's a writer himself, and he publishes a scathing review of his brother's book. This is based on something that actually happened to you.
It did happen. It was,
in
it was too good to waste. It was too good to waste. So my brother did review a book of mine. It was a scathing review, of course, but it was funny. I found it very comical. In the book, the character's hurt by it, but I found it so self-lacerating that it hurt him much more than it hurt me. And so there it is. This amazing bad review. I tried to think in literary history whether any author who had a brother, you know, Faulkner had a brother, Hemingway had a brother, name a writer and he probably had a brother. A male writer. Thomas Mann had a brother and Chekhov had a brother. Did any of them review the book of, but you know, did Hemingway's or Faulkner's brother or Chekhov's brother review the book or make a comment about the book? Sometimes they made a comment. Henry James' brother, William James, disparaged Henry's book, and he disparaged Henry for being vain and shallow. He said he's vain and shallow, but they were friends, you know, brothers, and they sort of plodded along. But there's no review. So I thought, well, here's a review. It happened to me. I'm never going to write an autobiography. It deserves a place in the history of this family. And it kind of fleshes it out. And then when you quote it, you see how odd it is, how just very, very strange it is. And for legal reasons, I could only quote 400 words, but, you know, this thing called fair use. But if I had quoted the whole thing, it would be even more astonishing. So I used that. As I say, I used my life to a large extent, but I would say it's only 60%. The other 40% is fiction, and it's me taking liberties with it.
Another thing that you seem to have drawn from your life is Jay's experience as a young college student when his girlfriend gets pregnant. They live in Puerto Rico to hide the pregnancy from their parents, and they give up the baby for adoption. This was a turning point, a similar experience in your life. Is that
yes,
true?
It is, and I've written about it. I've actually written about it several times in an early story called The Green is the Island, and then I wrote a short story which became a chapter in this book called The Best Year of My Life. And it, of course, was a very difficult time. A girlfriend becoming pregnant when you're 19 years old is really not a happy thing. But an amazing thing happened. And again, this is too good not to use. The child came back into my life. And he's a lovely person. And a very successful person. He's an athlete, a very good businessman, a kind and attentive father, and an exemplary person. I mean, he was raised by a lovely family, by an excellent family who encouraged him, nurtured him. And he became a wonderful person, looked for me and his birth mother. And there it is. And that's, again, too good not to use. I will say that I adapted it. I mean, because this is fiction, I rounded it off. I elaborated on it. I gave it a point. I gave it drama where in my life there was no drama. But that's that the writing of fiction is that no one can sit down. I mean, unless you're James Patterson or Stephen King or somebody, you sit down and you just spin your wheels and you make up a story about a ghost or a phantom or a dinosaur or a I don't know what, you know. And you don't talk about what really happened. I mean, Stephen King is a good example. He actually reviewed this book and he writes stories about spooky things. But he has said that the worst thing that ever happened to him was when he was hit by a car and broke his leg. Well, you know, life is like that. Breaking your leg, being hit by a car, is a terrible thing. Being locked in a hotel in some far-off place like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, or I didn't read the book, but I suppose The Shining, that doesn't happen. You know, in life, ghosts don't appear in life. What happens in real life is that you get hit by a car. Or you have an adopted child, you give a child for adoption, or they come back. That's the drama. That's the amazing. You know, the truth of life is really the amazing thing. The astonishing thing is when we're writing about reality. We now have a president who was a businessman. He was on. I used to watch The Celebrity Apprentice. How amazing! He's now president of the United States. I used to watch him on. Firing people on The Celebrity Apprentice. That's the truth of things. Much more interesting to me than a ghost story.
You quote the writer B. Travin when he writes, "The creative person should have no other biography than his work." And another passage in the book, you say that an author's life can be summed up by the totality of their works. So there will be no autobiography.
No, I really don't think I'm capable of writing an autobiography for various reasons, but the main one is that I've used so much of my life in my work. Virtually every interesting thing that I've heard, every amazing thing that's happened to me. I was in the Peace Corps. I was in Vietnam as a journalist. I was in China for a year writing a book. You know, all that stuff is, I've used it all. I've done it. And really there's nothing left to tell. The only thing that it would interest me would be to write a little introduction to each of my books to say where I wrote it, what gave me the idea, the circumstances of it. You know, I happened to be in a particular place. Someone told me this story. Say the Mosquito Coast. I was going to South America. I stopped in Costa Rica. The Mosquito Coast is an actual place on the coast of on the Caribbean coast. I got the idea for it. And then, you know, my father was a factor and the fact that I had children. And I was a pre-med student, inventiveness kind of. So all of that was factors in the Mosquito Coast. But the idea of an introduction to each of my books, as far as I would go, that is autobiographical. But a blow by blow about how I've lived my life or the things that have happened to me, I've used all that. I've put them all through the fictional meat grinder and given them drama on the page. There's nothing left to tell, really.
Right. I wonder if a biographer will have a hard time separating the fact from the fiction. Do you think so, or probably not?
No, they'd have a lot of trouble. What biographers tend to do is simplify, and they miss the essential pivot of a person's life. Not everything that you do is recorded. So they see the letters. They often really miss the point, and we know that because there are so many biographies. Let's take there. I have read 4 biographies of Flaubert. Each of them has something more to say. There's a new biography of Henry David Thoreau. Think of all the biographies of Henry David Thoreau there have been. This one by Laura Dassin Walls is an excellent one. It's coming out next month. Excellent biography of Thoreau. But there's dozens of them. I read 2 biographies of Ambrose Bierce this past winter, and they're different. Ambrose Bierce, who wrote An Occurrence in Owl Creek Bridge and The Devil's Dictionary, the biographies are different. So would a biographer have a tough time? He'd have a diabolical time writing my life, yes.
I liked this passage you wrote. So this is actually our protagonist, Jay, speaking. I lived my life and lived my crises in full view of the spectators who were my readers. I turned my crises into fiction and endured them that way, ultimately learning to value them. So it sounds like a reader can get to know you through your books. I mean, that's if they want to know Paul Theroux, just read the totality.
Definitely read the books. But Betraven said, which is a writer should have no other biography than his work, is true. If you want to know a writer, read all his or her books. Read all the books and you will know the person well. I always tell people that the way to read is to read widely and deeply. That it's not enough to read one book by a person. You've got to read them all. And the bad books, the poor books, the inadequate books, can be as interesting and telling as the great books, because the great books can be very artful and conceal things. But bad writing, an inadequate book by the same writer, can show you the inner life of the writer. And I would say, what I do is, I mean, I mentioned Ambrose Bierce. I've been reading Ambrose Bierce. I have his 10 volumes. He wrote lots of short stories, including ghost stories. He was the only great American writer to have fought in the Civil War. Stephen Crane did not fight in the Civil War, although he wrote The Red Badge of Courage. Stephen Crane read Ambrose Bierce. Ambrose Bierce is a somewhat neglected figure, but my point is, read all the works. And my little project with reading is always read all of Henry James, then read the biography of Henry James. Read read Wuthering Heights is one book by Emily Bronte, and then read a biography of Emily Bronte. Read the books, then read the biography, then read the letters, and you've got a good sense of, you've got a friend. You've got a friend in literature.
I'm talking with author Paul Theroux about his new book, Motherland, which is about a large family. It's set on Cape Cod. I'm Elsa Partan, in for Mindy Todd. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Elsa Partan, in for Mindy Todd. I'm talking with author Paul Theroux. His new book is called Motherland, and it's about a manipulative mother and her adult children and their struggles. This is such a Massachusetts and Cape Cod book, which I really appreciated. And there are references, of course, to Falmouth Hospital. You've got Cape Cod Hospital. You've got the Cape Cod Mall in there. You've got
Bax
Yarmouth.
Bax is on Hyannis Harbor. Yeah, all of
6A
that.
6A is
the
on
roads,
there.
Yeah, the roads.
The roads and everything.
The roads, the weather, the foliage, the trees, you know, the
The depressing
trees.
Way that winter kind of just wears winter, everyone down.
Yeah. The Rosa Rugosa, and also how lovely spring is, and the summertime. Summertime is just such bliss on the Cape. all of that, yes, is part of the life of this book.
And I wonder, there was also a part that I really loved, which where you sort of start thinking about, or Jay, the protagonist, starts thinking about accents and the way that a practiced listener actually can tell what part of Southie the priest is from, you know?
Well, that's true. You can. People say, oh, he's got a Boston accent. But there's no such thing as a Boston accent. There are a lot of accents in Boston. And there is a South Boston accent. There's a South End accent. There's a South Shore accent and a North Shore accent. And the North End, I mean, the Italian accent in the North End is very, very distinct. People would say, oh, that's not a Boston accent, but it is. And then the Cape, there's an accent on the Cape. You know, I was shocked. I tell you, I was shocked. Get over here. Did you listen to me? Get over here. He was shot. You say he was shot by a gun? No, no, no. He was shot. He was only about 5 feet tall. He was shot. So that kind of thing. There's a lot of them. Or the priest says, mortal sin. He committed a mortal sin.
Which you spell M-O-T-T-L-E.
Yes, M-O-T-T-L-E is how you pronounce
mortal
sin. It's a mortal sin, not a venial sin. So that's how I was raised, and those voices are in my head. I noticed they're in the movie. I used to think there wasn't enough, that the Boston accents were so interesting. There's so many of them in this, so that they were so good. They're too good to waste, and they didn't appear in movies or anything. But lately, you know, you see a lot of them, and you notice also someone like Mark Wahlberg and. What's his name? Damon.
Matt Damon.
Damon have different accents. Yep. I mean, one's Cambridge and the other's Boston, and so they're different, and it's pretty obvious that they're different. And I mean, I grew up in Medford, and we had an accent in Medford, which I think it's more or less the way I talk. It's certainly the one that I use in some of my writing. So.
Right, and I appreciate that you also would bemoan the loss of these accents, you know, sort of the melting down into like one American accent.
That's true.
I don't know if that's happening, but...
One of the great things about when I was traveling in the South for my Deep South book, I noticed there isn't one Southern accent either. I mean, there's coastal South Carolina, then there's inside, and then there's Alabama, and there's Arkansas. And different ones in Arkansas too, that when people lose their accents, and I think Americans' accents are eroding to a certain extent. It is sad, and then so when in Massachusetts people stop saying, "Well, it's spring, I'm going to buy some lawn ornaments," when they stop saying, "I'm going to buy some lawn ornaments," then we're going to hell in a handbasket.
Exactly.
You know, it's a factor of immigration, actually. The more immigrants you have, the more accents change. So, I mean, it's rare for a new immigrant to have a local accent. Accents come through generations and through people with deep roots. The main accent, and there are a number of main accents, but because Maine is not a place where many people have immigrated to recently, the main accent is very distinct.
I don't think it's a spoiler to reveal that the 102-year-old mother dies at the end of the book. There's a sense that the siblings are released from their requirement to ever see one another again. And I looked up to see when your mother died. She died in 2015.
My mother died 103, almost 104. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you seen your siblings since then?
No, funnily enough. But I may, who knows? I've only been here. I recently, in fact, 2 days ago, I was in Alaska giving a talk. And before then, I was in Hawaii, so for an extended period. So no, I haven't seen them. But the mother dies, and the children, yeah, they're released from their obligations, as you say. But also, they stop being children when our parents die. You know, as long as our parents are alive, we're children. We're their children. And we can be quarrelsome or childlike or childish because we have a parent. You lose your parents and suddenly you're next for the chopping block or whatever. But then you have to attain a degree of maturity is demanded of you. And you realize you're not a child anymore. You really have to, you're not a boy. You're a well, I'm not a boy. When my mother was alive, which is until, you know, not very long ago, she was 103. I was her son. I was a boy. And she often talked to me as though I was a boy. And I talk to my children as though they're boys, although they're, you know, they're in their 40s. So that's a strange thing. And, you know, it's part of the warp and weft of the book. As far as my own siblings go, well, you know, I mean, I've written lots of things about children, brothers, sisters, siblings, and I don't know. You just have to, you have to write and, you know, publish and be damned, I guess.
Hmm. And so they haven't read it yet that you know of?
I don't know. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay. I'm talking with author Paul Theroux about his new book, Motherland, which is about a large family. It's set on Cape Cod. At the end of the book, Jay finds a measure of peace with his mother, actually. A woman who's taking care of her in the nursing home actually helps him see her in a new light. Does Jay forgive her, do you think?
Oh, yes. I mean, after a certain... No matter how tyrannical a parent is, after, you know, old age kind of kicks in, 85, 90, 95, 100... They're beyond criticism. You can't really hold them responsible. And they become, as I describe the woman in the book, like a little goddess, a little, even though they might be malevolent in some ways, they're little shrunken figures, very old, you know, sitting there in the corner, much smaller than they used to be, and not really able to damage you anymore. And you see them as in my mother's case, like a little goddess, like a little our household god repelling evil, I suppose. And definitely they're forgiven. They have to be forgiven because you can't, past that age, hold them responsible. But when they're active, when you're young, your parents can be formidable. And even in your middle age, they can be formidable. So I think the mother in the book isn't one person. There are various phases in her life. And toward the end of her life, she's loved, forgiven, compassion is extended to her, and she's astonishing. She's amazing, actually, and in the book. And I think that's, you know, if you see the book as just an unhappy family with a tyrannical mother, it's kind of missing the point. It's a mother that evolves into a little yellow goddess.
Yeah, and actually she softens quite a bit, but not till really the very end, because even approaching 100, she's sort of able to wreak havoc, you know, in the family, but somehow in those last couple years, she does soften. She
softens, but there's a thing called homeostasis, which is unbalanced. It means kind of out of balance. And often in a family that's out of balance functions perfectly well. It's when someone tries to get it into balance, or someone tries to, you know, straighten it out, that things go wrong. That it functions like you know, with these mobiles that are, they're all different weights and shapes and forms, but it's in balance because of all the odd elements in it. And this is a family with a lot of odd elements that that the mother kind of keeps in motion, and keeps moving on. I suppose the salient point is that the siblings, who are in their 60s and 70s, behave like children. I mean, they're still children. And that always makes me laugh, because I think, I just think physically of gray, balding, heavy-set people in shorts.
You call them misshapen often.
Yeah, misshapen. But they're wearing shorts like little kids,
right, or,
you know, funny hats. And they still go to birthday parties, and they still kind of tease each other. They're relentless teasers. And I suppose, you know, that I find that appealing. Maybe I find this book funnier than most people, but I do think part of it is pure comedy.
Yeah. We haven't mentioned the character, the sort of invisible character, Angela, which is the long-dead child of mother. She dies as an infant, but she's actually a character. She's a sibling just like the rest of them.
Yes, this is one of the fictional elements of the book that a child died in at birth, and that but is present as a child would be in the mother's mind, still alive, growing, but perfect and without a blemish. And one of the curious paradoxes of the book is that the main character then meets a woman called Angela, who is the mother's caregiver, whom the mother confuses with the dead Angela and the live Angela, and the main character falls in love with her. And I won't spoil the ending, but it's a good ending. So that's, you can improve on life. I mean, I once wrote that fiction gives us the second chances that life denies us. I wrote that in a book called Saint Jack. And it's true. If you write books, if you write fiction, you can improve things. You can make them better. You can actually see them in a particular way. And you can give them order. If you don't write, you don't have that second chance. If you're a writer, you have a second chance to kind of improve things.
At the funeral of Mother, one of the siblings says to Jay, the writer, "Are you writing a book?" And I had to smile because I thought, you know, yes, he is, you know, but...
Yes, but all my life people have been saying that to me because I'm an inquisitive person, and I tend to ask too many questions for some people, but the only way I've ever managed to get through life is by interrogating people. I ask them about their work, their lives, and you know... Inevitably, someone says, after you've asked a lot of questions, "What are you writing a book? Leave this chapter out. Make it a mystery." In Hawaii, the expression is niele. Niele means nosy. And people aren't, they may be nosy, but they're not inquisitive there. So it's breaking all the rules of Hawaiian culture to ask a lot of questions. And I'm known as niele. That's, you know, I'm this guy, this niele guy with all the questions. So, hey, what are you writing a book? That seemed like a perfect thing for the main character to be asked at the end of the book that he's actually writing.
And we should mention that you live in Hawaii when you're not on Cape Cod. That's your other main residence. So that's why you have so many Hawaiian references to Hawaii over the years.
Yes.
You have traveled all over the world, but you have a house on Cape Cod. What keeps you coming back here?
I would come back here. I lived in England for a long time. I lived in Africa. I lived in, you know, Singapore. But when I lived in England, I really disliked it. I didn't like living in England. I lived there for 17 years. I didn't like it. The people are mildly hospitable, but mercurial in their way. I actually found it a kind of a chilly place culturally, and you're always reminded that you're a foreigner in England. You Yanks, people say, you Yanks. So I thought, as soon as I get some money, this is in the early to mid 70s, as soon as I earn it, I'll buy, it can be a dog house, a small house, but I want to get a place of my own on Cape Cod so that I can think that I have a place to go. I'm not at the mercy of the English people who are saying, "Oh, you Yanks." You know, funny enough, all the English people I knew then who were, you know, not particularly pro-American are all in New York. You know, Martin Amis, Salman Rushdie, you know, all these, I don't know, Zadie Smith. All, I mean, some of them are nice. They weren't necessarily anti-American, but they're all here. James Corden, John Oliver, you know, the guy on Dancing with the Stars. You know, turn around, there's an English person. E.B. White once said, an English person is not happy till he's explained America. And that's proving to be true. So I've always come back to the Cape. The Cape is my home. People can't kick you out. I'm here. I love the summer on the Cape. But even the winter, cross-country skiing on Sandy Neck Dunes. It was one of the great places to go cross-country skiing, but there's a lot of opportunities. I would come back here no matter where I lived. I live in Hawaii. That's a great place. But I still think this is home, and I love living on the Cape. We're lucky to live here. And I often think when I come back to the Cape that I've been to a place that's changed. England's changed. New York changes. Hawaii changes. California, you go there, something's different. There's a new hotel, or even in Hawaii, new buildings, eroded beaches, whatever. You come back to the Cape, nothing has changed. There's no fast food on Route 6A. There's no big buildings. We have a height restriction on the Cape. There's no hideous, we have hideous buildings, but they've been hideous buildings for as long as I've lived. There's no new hideous buildings that I can recognize. And I like the idea that I can come back to a place that hasn't changed. And that's why I will continually not only come back to the Cape, but consider the Cape where I belong and my home.
And Hawaii, has that become a place that you also feel like it's a permanent home for you as well?
No, it's not a permanent home, but it's a home. I mean, I have a house that I raise chickens in Hawaii. I have geese in Hawaii. I have animals. I don't on the Cape because raccoons would kill them. I mean, I trap raccoons all the time. But if I had chickens, the raccoons would be a problem. I would like to have animals here. So I have them in Hawaii. But I feel like pretty much a stranger. Even after almost 30 years in Hawaii, I feel, you know, that's a place where you're reminded. The word for white person is haole, or stranger. You're a haole. I'm a haole there. I'm just, you know, an older white guy. And here I'm not. I got a name and an address and so forth. And I grow tomatoes. But I do feel as if this is where I'm happy and this is where I belong. And where you're happy, you know, where you love living is a place that you don't, where you don't mind dying. So I think probably they can scatter my ashes here rather than somewhere else.
Are you working on a book right now?
I'm not working on a book, but I'm working on I have a project to travel around Mexico. Everyone's bad-mouthing Mexico, Mexican immigrants, and build a wall and all. I wrote a piece for Smithsonian Magazine about the border. I drove the 2,000 miles, and I went across the border a dozen times. And that interested me in a bigger, more ambitious trip in Mexico. So the last trip I took to Mexico was in Oaxaca to go to language school to improve my Spanish. And ultimately, I would just like to take a big, long road trip in Mexico and write about it. You know, there's nothing else. We self-employed people have to think of things to do. And that seems to be a nice thing to do. Maybe enlightening for me and perhaps for other people.
The book is Motherland, the new book by Paul Theroux. It's in bookstores now. Paul Theroux, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
I'm Elsa Partan, in for Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.